Thank you very much, Lynn. And hello, everyone. I am back with Timothy Conway. Timothy, would you like to say hello?
Greetings, each and every one.
And so my first question for you all is, can you hear Timothy nice and clear? We want to make sure that you can hear. Okay, good. Because otherwise, this is a waste of time. All right,
the
perfect.
Sound of silence.
Yeah.
As Paul Simon would have sung.
Yeah. Well, Timothy, it's just really, really good to be with you again. I was telling Timothy just before we came in the room that at the fall retreat this year, a friend named Stephen Klo came up and said that he had been to Timothy's the previous Tuesday. And I thought, oh, I would love to see Timothy again. And that's what led to me asking him to come back to do another satsang with us. So thank you for saying yes once again.
It's so easy to say yes to Regina Dunn.
Thank you.
To the cosmos.
So where to just, I know once our discussion begins, I know that it will just flow. It always does. So the question is where to begin. What I did this morning was I went and listened to the brief satsang excerpt that I believe his name is Thomas has put on YouTube.
Yes, yes, he's been a busy bee working on his own writing projects, but he loves our Tuesday evening satsang gatherings, and he's been very laboriously, you know, not only recording them and uploading them, but making sure the individual sections through time are properly at the right sound levels and everything. And he had the idea to finally get some more stuff up on YouTube, because I have zero ambition about any of this. And you know, the stuff just kind of flows through, but he's archiving it and created some lovely slideshows of local nature sites here in Santa Barbara, up at the bluffs or out at the beach and so forth. And I know recently he did one on some lovely images I helped furnish him with of Ramana Maharshi. And there was a brief excerpt about the graciousness of Ramana Maharshi.
Mm.
As a spiritual figure, and in not seeing anyone as unenlightened.
Yes, I listened to that one this morning as well. And, you know, for anybody who's listening right now, if you'd like to go and find those on YouTube, they're short. They're like, what, 8 to 12 minutes usually, short little clips. Mm-hmm. And beautiful. You only hear Timothy, but beautiful images to look at while you're listening to Timothy. It's really wonderful. So you said you have no ambition. You're not out there trying to become the most famous spiritual teacher on the planet Earth.
How could spirit do that to itself?
Well, why don't we start by just talking about what's life like in the day of Timothy?
Well, rather conventional in some ways. I mean, you know, there's a lot of communication with their folks around the world. It's always right here, this one. Self-same self, and it, you know, serves up at different stages of the awakening, and perhaps different comments or questions about spirituality. And so I deal with a lot of email people, and, you know, it's all for free. I don't have a paid PayPal system in place. Who knows, I could always change down the road if, you know, financially we were ever on the brink of absolute poverty or something, might ask for a little help. But it's the grace of God that even though we'll probably be moving from Santa Barbara this coming year, most likely, and some of it is financial pressure. But I also am hugely at work at these massive research projects. So I'm hoping also this year to finish up this big source book on Chan and Zen Buddhism. And because I love the non-dual tradition that expressed itself in East Asia. It's very earthy, very unpretentious, and full of just delightful sensitivities and sensibilities, like the wabi-sabi notion out of Japanese Zen.
And what is that? I don't know what that is.
And even the Japanese have a hard time translating that to themselves, let alone into English or something. It's that wonderful sense of the perfection the imperfect. Just as an illustration, the great 16th century Japanese Zen-style tea master, Sen no Rikyu, he wasn't interested in all that gorgeous pottery coming out of Ming China or Korea. He was interested, and he had actual some friends who were ceramicists, potters, and so forth in villages not far from him. And he would go and get their pottery ware because he loved the delightfully drab colors. He loved the imperfection on the lip, the rim of one of the teacups or tea bowls, and the uniqueness of each precious object within the great dream of life. So he didn't see these as shortcomings and flaws. He saw them as the individuated, irreplaceable, unduplicable,
yes,
beauty, the suchness, to use the Buddhist term that the Zen people made a lot out of, just the suchness. So, you know, for instance, as we go through the day, we might see a person with an old and wrinkled face or something. I'm not, if you had Skype, you would see this old and wrinkled face.
No, you still look great.
You know, each line, where did that line come from in the wrinkled face? You know, those hands of that person, you know, who have they caressed? What babies have they held? What, you know, diapers have they changed? When you look at a conventional object, you know, who was the person who was working probably some suboptimal non-living wage job who packaged that for you? The whole sense of the suchness and what seems to be the flawed or not glamorous, not grandiose, everydayness quality of something or someone. That's wabi-sabi. It's also a fierce and poignant sense of the impermanency of everyone and everything. So I love the East Asian traditions, Japanese as well as Korean. The Korean Zen, for instance, what they call son, is much earthier than like the Japanese tradition, which had also, in addition to elements like wabi-sabi, obviously a lot of samurai influence from 600 years of military rule of that country up until the 1868 Meiji Restoration, which brought us state Shinto, and of course a bit later World War II in the Pacific. So anyway, the whole field of Chan, Son, and Zen, it's just so rich with non-dual insight, beautiful pointing back in straight prose and the most gorgeous poetry about our true nature. It's open, unborn, changeless, prior to space-time, prior to language, great reality, the Buddha nature, our true self.
Well, you know, I find that, you know, you were talking about, first of all, once you started talking about the wabi-sabi or whatever it was, I understood it perfectly. I used to live in Japan. And I remember I went to a pottery place once, very expensive, you know, all artistic pottery, but the most expensive pot in the place had a crack in it. And as a Westerner, I could not understand why the flawed one was the most expensive. And so they were explaining this to me in the way that they could, that this was unique. And, you know, this was the, you know, the finger of God, you know, where the others were all routine, but this one was very, very special. Or in the West, that's, we would have said, we would have thrown that one away.
No, that's a beautiful, perfect illustration of exactly this wabi-sabi notion.
Yes.
Well, I understand. It's become kind of an aesthetic, you know, plus in some circles of, you know, interior design in the West. Mm. Someone's been picking up on it. I understand there's a few books that have come out in the last 5 or 10 years about wabi-sabi. But the way psychologically or spiritually that applies, it's like a lot of spiritual aspirants are so ashamed of their own flaws.
Their own body, their own inner, yes.
Yeah, the complexes they might have inherited from a dysfunctional family system. And it's so easy to quickly jump on oneself. It's the conscientious people in life, incidentally, I found. You know, the really sincere and good-hearted people who are trying to be part of the solution rather than being little brats and proud of the fact that they're independent and my own person. And, you know, it's the conscientious, very sincere people who are often beating themselves up the hardest over their perceived flaws. And to just take the God's eye view or the Buddha nature view, so to say, on this personal consciousness instrument, if you have that appreciation of the wabi-sabi, you'll be moved to tears by the poignancy and precious flaws and just the overall precious nature of the personal consciousness instrument. You are not that. You are the absolute. And yet you, as absolute, the transcendent openness, infinitude, are host to a fantastic cosmic play filled with all these personifications of your suprapersonal transcendental nature. And these persons, including the one that conventionally gets called you, or psychologically is felt as me, this personal consciousness is a delight for the divine. The divine worships its emanations, its sons and daughters, its beautiful emanations out of spirit into the appearance of a personal consciousness with a body-mind set of instrumentation. So it's like the body-mind is an instrument, yet the person itself, the personal consciousness or soul, what they call jiva in India, is also an instrument of the formless, infinite, unborn divine.
Well, in fact, when I was listening this morning, I wrote down some possible questions. I knew that this conversation was going to go where it was going to go, but I just wrote down some possible questions that I thought might be interesting, and you just touched on one of them. You said something in one of the audios that I was listening to. You said, personal consciousness through the power of primordial consciousness rooted in absolute awareness.
Yes. Well, you know, there's a lot of people that talk about consciousness, but if we're going to be strict or faithful to our semantic traditions, the word consciousness in Western philosophy and now in kind of the science of consciousness, you've got a journal of consciousness studies and conferences, and often it's a lot of physicists and Western academic philosophers who dominate these things. Consciousness, strictly speaking, that means that which is aware of, and we get kind of circular in our definitions, it's that which kind of registers and can be sentient for objects. Consciousness is involved with objects.
Subject and object, yeah.
My own Advaita, non-dual teacher of India, Sri Nisargadatta, kind of articulated three levels of this. And what you shared, what I was saying spontaneously in some satsang, because, you know, I don't plan any of those satsangs. I never know what I'm going to say until kind of our silent gazing after our 30-minute sitting is over. I'm not during the meditation thinking of things to say. No, I just trust whatever comes through in the moment, right now. Sometimes it's just silence. So Sri Nisargadatta expresses three levels, and it's what you were hearing, that quote you read from this one that Thomas put up at that YouTube site. He distinguished between the personal consciousness, the universal consciousness, and the absolute awareness. Now, how do these differ? The absolute awareness, we'll start here, is just the open nothingness, worldless, relationless, absolute emptiness and yet fullness, full as awareness, full as aliveness, divine life, not limited to any bodies or structures or parts or anything. This is the absolute. And it's simultaneously to being timeless and formless, utterly pristine and spotless and speckless. It comes up with a speck, energy, the primordial shakti, the prana shakti, as it gets called in Eastern tradition out of India, and Far Eastern tradition would be known as like the qi energy in China. You know, the Tao, Taoism gives birth to the one.
Yeah.
The one is the energy. And then that energy, you know, Chinese Taoism gives rise to the two, yin and yang, and the five elements, and the myriads and myriads of things, the countless things and beings, and all the countless worlds. So the absolute awareness has no world, or relations, or any thing at all, any phenomena at all, yet it spontaneously can originate through the seed syllable om, as the ancient Upanishads, our most ancient wisdom texts, articulated it. Through the om, the primordial open awareness originates a primordial field of consciousness, energy. And that's what gives rise then to the individual points of consciousness, if you will, the viewpoints on reality. Like there's a Regina Dawn viewpoint on reality. There's a Timothy viewpoint. There's a Barack Obama viewpoint. There's a little bird singing in the on the branch of the tree, the little bugs and other kind of organisms in the soil, their viewpoint on reality. Deities, our departed so-called dead, deceased ancestors, they're right now very alive as subtle plane kind of beings, animating, expressing a certain viewpoint on the great reality. So somehow the one reality comes up with a potential for emanating, you know, multi-level, multi-dimensional cosmic manifestation, and then all these beings, all these apparently sentient persons within the cosmos. Now, I call them apparently sentient because when one really contemplates this personal consciousness, one realizes that it is an instrument. It doesn't have its own sentience or power. It's like if the moon were to contemplate its great light that it shines, say, onto the planet Earth, it would soon realize this light is not my own. It's borrowed light from the sun. And I'm an instrument by which the sun can illumine the night sky for people, other kind of beings on Earth. In the same way we disidentify from being merely the personal consciousness, we can start tapping into a transpersonal kind of collective consciousness, the great ocean of consciousness or a great field of consciousness, which is manifesting all persons and all inanimate structures from, you know, the subatomic level to the, you know, galactic clusters and subtle plane and environments and so forth. So this great universal consciousness play is just that. It's a play. It's a great dream that somehow the divine dreamer, our absolute nature, spontaneously, without worries apparently, without fretting, without getting all fragmented, dreams up for the sake of relationship, adventure, cellular evolution, biological evolution. Only God could be dreaming this. It's too fantastic otherwise.
Well, let me ask you this question. Oops.
Yeah.
I hear a little bit of an echo, but I'll ignore it. Let me ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about the human consciousness, and how, of course, it's related to consciousness and related to awareness, and it's all a big play. It sounds wonderful. Is there a reason for a person to put effort into awakening beyond the personal consciousness, or should they just play and have fun with their current experience?
You'll have no choice about certain things because the personal consciousness, you, small case letters, Y-O-U, the personal self, small case S-E-L-F, is an instrument of the divine. And this divine is obviously exuberant in a divine way, just beggars description. It's so fantastic, the forms of expression that the divine is coming up with. And we see in the history of this cosmos, emergent complexity out of the early energy radiation era of the cosmos, there arose a material era. But, you know, that material era didn't just generate hydrogen and helium, which is actually what the bulk of the physical cosmos is made of in terms of knowable matter. We now know, obviously, most of the matter is dark matter, mystery matter, missing matter. And then since 1998, it's been astonishingly clear and one of the great upsets to scientific arrogance in the modern world, they realize most of the energy is missing. So the most recent Cambridge Planck observational data in the last two or three years says that, you know, the 13.82 billion-year-old cosmos on the physical level, I'm not talking about subtle plane energies, but the physical cosmos, is less than 5% knowable matter. Another 26% or so is some kind of dark mystery matter. And then the rest of it, about 68, 69% is dark energy, missing mystery energy, that is not converting into either dark matter or knowable matter. Knowable matter meaning everything that's been known to science, you know, in particle physics, you know, electrons, the Higgs bosons, neutrinos, you know, pulsars, quasars, you name it. That's all knowable matter, and it's less than 5% of what they know is here. That just takes scientific arrogance that, you know, Hawking and others were expressing right up into the mid-90s. Oh, this, you know, give us a little more time. Any month now, any year now, we'll have the theory of everything. They have been humbled, taken to their knees in ways it still hasn't really hit the average layman who thinks the scientists really know a lot. They don't realize how the scientists have been extraordinarily humbled, especially since 1998, when it was realized there was this mystery energy that was much more rapidly expanding the galaxies away from each other than they had previously detected. So this is stunning. They're either all their scientific theories are really radically wrong in the premises, which would lead to even more humbling, or there's an energy here that's just so fantastic, that's beyond anything the scientists have ever previously conceived of in terms of how it converts into different modes of expression. We know its mode as detectable matter, but now we know that's only less than 5% of the cosmos. So how can one be a materialist when matter has just been completely relegated to just like flotsam within the cosmic play? You know, foam and flotsam.
And so this mystery energy would be what we call God, sort of.
But God is the source of energy.
Okay.
So in physics, matter, energy, space, time, those were always considered the fundamentals. Now we know that matter has a far, far less important role to play somehow, at least in terms of the constituents of the cosmos. It seems to be quite minor. And most of matter, as we know it in the cosmos, is just hydrogen and helium.
So the mystery energy would be more like the finger of God, then?
Yes.
Okay.
See, the great sagely tradition is saying quite clearly that this whole play of phenomena, the whole universal consciousness play manifesting as inanimate and animate phenomena and beings, is just a speck within a speck of the absolute infinite nature of pure spirit.
And so this finger of God, then, this is what causes us, because you said when I asked the question about should we even try to awaken, this would lead one person to want to meditate all day long and another person to not care at all and be totally focused on the stock market and politics?
Perhaps. And divine that's manifesting all this emergent complexity through the, you know, biological evolution. I mean, just the evolution of hydrogen and helium into stars, and then second generation stars and later generation stars, which are the stars that give rise to an absolutely miraculous interior core process to the heavier elements, you know, including all the elements, most of the elements of the periodic table of chemistry. Those only arose in second generation and later generation stars. And then when those stars died and exploded, they spewed out that heavier than hydrogen and helium kind of elements, which this, in some cases congealed into little planetesimals. Most were just shattered by impact with other planetesimals and various other kind of objects, meteors and comets and so forth. But then there were the lucky planetesimals that emerged, grew, crude matter, and then later were able to withstand and take impacts from other solid objects. And those became planets. And then on a planet like ours, there's an emergent complexity of really interesting kind of molecular amino acid chains that could give rise to life as we know it. That's still a mystery. Biologists still don't know what the actual origins or place of origins of life were. There's the theory of, you know, right on that tiny, tiny little threshold between extremely cold and extremely hot, right by these thermonuclear vents at the bottom of the ocean. I think maybe life began to take hold right there. But where did it really come from? It came from comets. Well, where did the life on those comets come from? You know, that then got deposited onto Earth. So there's all this emergent complexity. And then, you know, obviously not just life, but multicellular life. And then, you know, from dinosaurs to the cetaceans like dolphins and whales to primates, humans. It's an incredible play of emergent complexity. There's great energies, great efforts that are being expended, but by whom? So a person, an individual personal consciousness, may get the inspiration to become, you know, very inspired over art or music or you know, helping heal our political shadow and bringing justice and fairness into our world, righting different wrongs, being an instrument of peace where there is war, an instrument of love where there was hate, and so forth and so on. You know, there's tremendous fires, furnaces of creativity shaping new forms, new dynamic directions to a life and its manifestations in work, play, creativity, relationship. We don't know what this power is that's powering all of this. It's shapeless, colorless, this power, textureless, formless. And yet right now it's understanding language, speaking language in the Timothy case. It's and all the other people around the planet now are in the subtle sphere is communicating language. We don't know how we digest food, how we grow hair, how we develop a fertilized egg cell in our mother's womb into a little baby that gets later felt as me.
Well, you know, what you're doing, what you're doing, at least for me, I don't know if others are hearing it, but we started with this discussion. I've already forgotten the Japanese word, but how the
wabi-sabi.
Yes, the wabi-sabi. Mm-hmm. What I'm hearing now is you're going through this description of what some people would call evolution. What I'm hearing is why everything is perfect as you're going through this. I'm hearing that, you know, so, you know, pick a flaw, you know, a mole right on the face or a big birthmark right on the face that somebody may their entire life be so embarrassed about. But when you think that it came about in this way that you're describing how this whole universe has just formed, it just formed out of this miraculous nothingness.
Yes.
Then every single thing is an incredible miracle. There is nothing that is not a miracle.
Amen. And alleluia, sister. Alleluia.
Yeah, well, this is what I was feeling as you were talking.
Praise God, from whom not only all blessings flow, but all beings and worlds.
Yeah, and moles and birthmarks and cellulite and, you know, beer bellies.
Hey. So, you know, I do advocate eating a plant-based diet.
Yes.
It's cruelty-free. You know, dairy involves terrible cruelty. Any vegetarians listening, straight away avail yourself of the incredible dairy substitutes. Wean thyself, O suckling one, on the secretions of another animal.
Whoops, I lost you. Hopefully you'll be right back. Right now you're frozen for me.
It's headed out of Cornell, the China study. You know, he found out that casein, that dairy protein, is highly, highly, highly correlated, if not causative, for many cancers.
But what about, let's talk about your teacher, Nisarg Gadatta, because isn't he someone?
He knew nothing about any of that.
Okay.
That was his flawed wabi-sabi side. You know, most Indians thought that meat, the British, you see, were hammering it home all the time. The British are the ones that destroyed the great grasslands of Ireland and Scotland, and then the Great Plains states in America, right where you are, east of the Rockies, the great grasslands stretching over, you know, to the Mississippi area before you get to the eastern arboreal, you know, forested kind of ecosystems. Those great grasslands were destroyed by the British so that they could get fatty beef. And it was a whole, I don't want to go into it. You know, they brought in the cavalry after the Civil War. They destroyed all the buffalo, which got rid of the Plains Indians. They could shunt them all off up onto those, you know, barren lands and the reservations in the Dakotas. And then they ranged through the kind of cattle the British loved. The British helped finance the whole thing. The British helped fund the Transcontinental Railroad. They'd invented refrigeration, and within a week or two, they could have, you know, frozen, thawing out, fatty beef fed on the grasslands of the United States' former Great Plains, now utterly denatured and almost desertified into grasslands that had been munched to death by the purposely dumb-bred cattle. And they could have that, you know, for their fatty beef dinners. But it destroys the health, you know, fills your arteries with plaque, and then not only do you die early, but a lot of your years you can't think clearly or function properly because all that saturated fat is completely clogging the arteries. And then you add an addiction to dairy, and you'll get even more of it. And no one gives a fig what actually happens to the cows. And whose babies are stolen from them, they weep and mourn for days. They're repeatedly forced raped to stay in a state of pregnancy, so they'll lactate, and then the humans steal all that milk away from their babies and then go make their ice cream and butter and stuff. It's hideous. It's been said, you know, there's more suffering in a glass of milk than in a you know, pound of burger, and it's certainly true. Yeah. Don't start me on the poultry industry. You know, countless millions and billions of little fully sentient little persons, the little male chicks, they have fully connected nervous systems. You know, people bring up the question of abortion, but, you know, before the fifth month, that little embryo and then fetus, it's alive, but it's not yet sentient because there's no nerve connections. There's no transmission of any pain signals or anything, let alone thoughts and emotions. The soul hovering above the physical plane, that's, you know, capable, obviously, of thought and communication. But the actual embryo turning into a fetus, before the fifth month, there's no there's aliveness, but no sentience. Yet, fully sentient little male chicks were largely useless. 98% of them, 99% of them are kind of useless in the poultry industry, are just ground up in big metal claws every second of every day. Massive, massive carnage. And no one even thinks about that when they have an omelet or, you know, have that piece of fried chicken or whatever. So part of becoming really free and clear of narrow self-obsessiveness on the personal consciousness level as you start awakening, receding back, as Sri Nisargadatta used to say, into the fuller universal consciousness and the transpersonal experiences of shared consciousness with fellow beings, one becomes more and more aware of what is right and true. And I have to say that most sages in India were kind of locked into a culture that just took dairy for granted. Now, there wasn't the abuses of intensified industrial dairy operations until recent decades. And I was going to say the British, you know, got all the Indians very self-conscious. The reason the British had been able to conquer them is because they were a stronger civilization. Where did that strength come from eating beef?
Yeah.
It's a complete lie. It's a complete lie. Gandhi even bought into it. Mahatma Gandhi bought into it early in his life and felt he had to eat meat. And he felt rotten from it. Literally, he was eating corpses, so he's going to feel rotten. And then a Jain friend of his, one of his real mentors in life, showed him how you could be much stronger than the British by eating a plant-based diet, just doing certain kinds of exercise, build a little muscle mass, but through plant food. And the Gandhi was still a lacto-vegetarian. He still drank milk. Today, you talk to a lot of these bodybuilders that have checked out vegan diets. They've functioned much better on a vegan diet than a lacto-over-vegetarian diet, or certainly on the former diet. They ate the standard American diet, S-A-D. That's very sad. It kills everyone prematurely of strokes and heart disease and diabetes and so forth. I was not too long ago encountering an article about an older gentleman. He's in his 80s. He's run all these super or ultra marathons where you like run 50, 80, 100, 150 miles at a time. And he used to be a lacto-ovo vegetarian, and now he's gone completely vegan. He says his recovery time is far better in his 80s than when he was in his 60s eating a lacto-ovo vegetarian diet. He's gone utterly vegan and says he's much stronger now, much clearer. So that's just one anecdote to kind of inform you that plants are where it's at. So, you asked about Nisargadatta. Because he was a meat eater. And there are areas where even someone like a great sage like Sri Nisargadatta, they just didn't have all the information. They weren't fully sensitive to what's going on this planet. And there can always be further awakening. That's why the Chan and Zen tradition speaks of the direct sudden awakening to our formless, unborn, timeless absolute nature. Yet that's spontaneously followed by an ego-free process of development of more and more virtues, capacities, knowings in the pragmatic field of experience within the dream. So they speak of sudden awakening, gradual cultivation. Sudden awakening to our intrinsic truth, and then actualizing the Buddha nature through the gradual cultivation. And the difference is that gradual cultivation of skill building and allowing the virtues to grow more and more beautifully, blossoming further. It all happens in an ego-free way. There's no longer a sense of I need to become more loving. It's just let the love grow, let it flow. And it happens by simply not interfering, not being a self-obsessed me that derails the process and gets neurotic about it.
Okay, so
that's all the difference between spiritual practice and so-called discipline carried out spontaneously, and it's happening. In a sense, God is doing your spirituality at this point. It's no longer an ego maintenance project or fabrication project. It's all just happening.
So then would you
profound enlightenments every day.
So would you say then, for example, what you just talked about as far as like having a plant-based diet, that this is clarity that grew on you at some point naturally, and as the clarity grew on you naturally, you began to give up? I mean, I assume you weren't always plant-based diet. Is that true? Were you a normal American eater?
Well, eating the standard American diet,
yeah,
like nobody's business. I headed over to the Hawaiian Islands when I was 20. My sister was already over on Maui. My sister was a year younger than me, and independently of me, about a year after I was undergoing these spontaneous, life-changing, profound awakenings to the fact there is only this reality, God doing everything and being everyone. And we're all made out of God's love and joy and creative power. My sister, about a year later, with the Rainbow People up in Wyoming, was undergoing her own openings. And she went out to Hawaii in her 19th year and became a vegetarian, largely vegan, just plant-based, no dairy. But she ate a little bit of dairy at that point still. And I joined her out on Maui Island, but en route, I was on Oahu Island in Honolulu. I was eating Big Macs and drinking milkshakes right up to the last meal before I hopped the inter-island plane and flew over. And she's there with her backpack. I had my backpack. It was a backpacking thing. We were mainly going to be spending time on the eastern Boonies side of the island, the very undeveloped side of the island, where she had been living, caring for an old blind man on his property and playing music with some flower children kind of folks on other parts of the little hamlets and huts and yurts and so forth out there on the island. And so I got out of the airport in Kahului in Maui, and my sister greets me, and we're heading along. We're going to hitchhike over to that eastern part of the island. And she says, "You must be hungry." And I said, "Yeah, I haven't had lunch yet." So we sat down on the grass there by the road. And she pulled out of her backpack this big cellophane bag filled with water and something else in it. And she opens it up, and she had a little bowl, a little teak bowl she carried with her. She had a few, one for me, one for her. And she put this stuff in the bowl, and she carved off a chunk and gave it to me. And I ate it, and I said, "What is this, chalk jello?" She goes, "Tofu. It's tofu."
Chalk jello.
And that was my introduction to eating a bit differently, getting off the standard American diet. She and her friends were all living on food stamps, courtesy of the largesse of the Hawaiian state government. And I was getting fed. I'd blown most of my money in Oahu. It was much more expensive than I thought there. So I was getting fed these wonderful salads and this and that, pastas and lentil rice dishes, you name it. I was being really fed the most wholesome food I'd ever eaten. And I felt so much stronger, so much clearer. The arteries were just clearing open by the day. By the end of that month, my physiology had been completely healed. I'd been a total jock, totally addicted to sports my youth. But in my late teens, I could already feel something's wrong. I don't have the energy I had when I was like 12 and 15. And unbeknownst to me, my arteries were getting completely plugged up. It's like the studies, the autopsies they did after the Korean War. The young Korean boys, 18, 20, 24 years old, you know, had grown up and eaten nothing but like rice, whole grain rice diet with, you know, some vegetables, some fruits and nuts, seeds, that kind of thing. And the American guys were already, you know, nearly 50s, they're eating a lot of steak and mashed potatoes, baked potatoes slathered in butter and everything, sour cream. And the young American guys who died, the autopsies performed revealed that their arteries were already showing all the signs of severe atherosclerosis developing, hardening of the arteries, plaque formation on the arteries. They were all getting narrowed down, so there wasn't enough blood going to all their organs. And that big organ sucks a lot of energy to the bloodstream, the brain. So most people are killing themselves with their forks and their food choices in the restaurants and fast food places and when they go shop. And it becomes a matter of supreme ethical importance. How can you talk about love when one is complicit with, like, the slaughter of billions and billions of creatures every year? That whole corpse-eating cult. I have to say it, frankly, I'm sorry if I offend anyone, but we're all indoctrinated in this because our most dominant ancient cultures were pastoralist cultures basically owned and confined to a certain extent cattle, sheep, goats, later pigs, later poultry, and created a whole system of horror, of absolute horror for beings whom modern science, especially in the last 5, 10, 15 years, has shown are just as much persons as we are. They feel emotion even more intensely than we do. We're often kind of dissociated and distracted by language and entertainment and, you know, movies and so forth. We can escape our emotions. They can't escape their emotions unless they're yogis. And I suspect many animals have yogic abilities. But they're subjected to forms of torture and hideous death that beggars description. There's now documentary movies, short 4-minute films that Farm puts out. They're trying to show every college kid on every campus with their mobile little video display units. And then longer films like the one narrated by Joaquin Phoenix, Earthlings. that 60 of those 90 minutes, let's say, if you don't become a vegan after that, something's morally wrong. There's a stunted development going on. Because once one sees where the standard American diet, the Northern European kind of diet, what's now been exported to the urban areas of Japan and China and Singapore and so forth, when you see where that food comes from, you are no longer innocent if you still desire to participate in that. So with awakening comes profound ethical awareness. Because when you're truly empathetic, when you truly love thy neighbor as thyself, which is the outgrowth of loving this God self, the one Adonai Lord with all thy soul, heart, mind, and strength, as the Torah teaches, what Jesus then taught is his two greatest commandments, who's a Jewish rabbi after all. When you truly are opened up to loving thy neighbor as thyself, there's tremendous empathy. So, you know, for this one, I still wasn't aware about the dairy connection, but within a couple of years, I had become largely macrobiotic. Then I went out to India, and I realized I got to consume a little bit of dairy because the food over there is just laced with dairy. They put it in everything. Every vegetable dish is laced with ghee, which is that clarified butter. And if you don't have the enzyme in your body to digest these milk products, you can get very ill. And I knew that it was already going to be difficult in India dealing with, you know, the different pathogens that are in the water and so forth. You know, I needed to get some of that lactase enzyme in me again. So I started eating a little bit of yogurt. My skin crawled the first few times I tried to consume it. The body was literally saying, I thought you were weaned. What are you putting this stuff in me for? But then I got used to it. And I lived in a spiritual household in San Francisco through the 1980s. And there was so many shared meals and potlucks, and most everybody was lacto-vegetarian. So I ate a certain amount of that when I'd be in social situations or in a place like India. But on my own, I've eaten pretty strictly vegan for the last, 42 years or something?
Yeah.
40 years, I should say. And more recently, you know, looking at the work of people like, well, my good friend Will Tuttle, who wrote The World Peace Diet several years ago. That book was number one on Amazon.com for a few days. So the best sequel to John Robbins' book, Diet for a New America. You must all know who John Robbins is. He left the Baskin-Robbins ice cream dynasty fortune to advocate essentially a vegan diet and tell people really where their food comes from. Meat, eggs, fish, like a factory farmed fish. That's a very ugly scenario. And then dairy, which has so much suffering in it. So you come to an emotional, empathetic, and ethical realization. I can't participate in that. And you seeing the danger, the horror of that, the danger for the animals, the horror for the animals, and then what it's doing to humans, killing us off. And get this, the most recent really good studies from Robert Goodland and Jeff Onhang, formerly of the World Bank, they wrote this incredible piece for Lester Brown's World Watch Institute in 2009, where they showed that at least 51%, at least 51% of all the global greenhouse gases responsible for this dreadful, dreadful worsening climate change, at least 51% of the contributory greenhouse gases are due to livestock emissions.
I heard that, yes. Yes, I heard that.
So there's a cult that's killing us all on the physical level, the phenomenal, manifest level here, because as souls, we're deathless, and as the absolute, we're unborn. But within the dream, the great play of beings and their relationships and their environs and their responsibilities and duties as, say, a world citizen, one has to be clear that there's a cult and it's killing us all. And it's not, you know, the fanatic pseudo-Muslim ISIS or ISIL cult in the Middle East. It's the meat-eating cult. This is the one that almost everyone's been indoctrinated into. the one that when you leave, you get tremendous flack and criticism and scorn from the meat eaters. You know, oh, what are you going to do? Just eat rabbit food? Tofu gets maligned. It's one of the great wonder foods. Just go through the Orient. The doctors know, all those older East Asian people that eat their rice and vegetable and tofu diet and other kind of legumes and pulses and so forth, and grains. Their arteries and overall health is far, far better than their, you know, 18, 25-year-old grandchildren who have been eating the standard American diet and are probably going to drop dead before they're 50 or 60. Unless they have that heart transplant and that all that kidney work and, you know, this drug and that drug and this drug and that drug. That's traditional East Asian diet is the healthiest diet on the planet. And among the Chan and Zen and Pure Land Buddhist people, they turned it into an utterly vegan diet. And you know, so many of those monks and nuns and laypersons live well into their 90s. So it's obviously a very healthy diet. And so I'm putting all that out there. It's just part of the universe doing what it does. And it's basically sharing a message that you can accept or not about spontaneously allowing everything to shift. And I tell you, your body, any people that you're sharing food with, like in a family situation, preparing meals, all of that will be,
Sure.
Just deal with something. I forgot to turn off the phone system earlier.
I do have a question, so when you're ready, I'll get to that question.
Yeah, I'm off the soapbox.
Okay, let's see. I think I might have to scroll back up to get the full question. She says, I have to leave to take care of my critters, but can you ask him about Shakti when he takes questions? So let me see if there was anything more specific she wanted to know about Shakti. Nope, she just says, I found her first time she asked the question. She says, just ask him about Shakti. I keep losing it when I don't know if anybody else has.
I expect that everything that's happening in the realm of the dream, all phenomena, are the play of Shakti.
Okay,
Shakti is the great mysterious manifesting power of the Absolute. I've got to turn off that phone.
Yeah, I know. I have the same problem that happens to
you. Still on, so. There we go.
Okay.
Sorry.
So go ahead and tell, for those of us who aren't real clear on what Shakti is, go ahead and start at the basic beginning and tell us about that.
Well, let's just bring in the Western parallel. In the beginning of that last gospel to be put in the New Testament, the one that was deliberately kind of originated to counter the Gospel of Thomas, body of sayings of Jesus, very mystical sayings, this fourth canonical gospel, the John Gospel, the community that came up with it, the so-called Johannine, John-based community, that gospel, that's the one that gave us that notion of Jesus is the Christ, the only begotten Son of God, you know, all of this that later got worked up into that heavy creedal theology by the 4th century and engendered all the wars, theological wars of the 3rd and 4th century as to, you know, was Jesus fully human or was he fully God or was he somehow both? I mean, if they had the notion of an avatar manifested out of the Supreme Brahman like ancient India had, they would have solved that. Yes, he's human, but we all are human as human persons, along with the animal persons, and we're all emanations of the one divine Brahman nature, the one reality, God, if you will. So the John Gospel is the one that gave us all that high-flown theology that Jesus is the Christ, the only begotten Son. But if you go right to the beginning of the John Gospel, there's this prologue, and it speaks of the Word of God, the Logos. And the Word, you know, was with God, and the Word was God, through whom everything was made, without whom nothing was made. The Logos is basically the vibrational power of the ever-quiescent infinite divine. It's the capacity, out of divine silence and stillness, to generate a vibrating energy phase and material phase of a cosmos, such as ours, come up with planets and life on a planet such as ours, higher forms of life. It's the what the ancient Upanishads speak of as the prana, and later the tantric, pure tantric traditions of India speak of as shakti, the prana shakti. It's the om, the primordial vibrational power of the divine. So in the ancient Upanishads, they speak of this om as the vach, the speech of God. And then many centuries later, you have that preamble to the or prologue to the John Gospel, speaking about the logos, the word of God, the vibrational power of God. So that's the shakti. Shakti is a later term. It arises in the context of the North Indian pure tantra traditions. I call them pure tantra to distinguish from the sexual tantras and, you know, other things where they, you know, ritually would eat meat and have intercourse and drink wine to purposely flout the ethical conventions of Indian spirituality. We should also even give us a little brief little thing about that kind of tantra. Because there's tantric workshops here in the United States and Europe and places that just completely, it's all about self-indulgence, has nothing to do even with the spirit of the left-hand tantric paths of India. They adopted things like meat-eating and ritual fornication, coitus, ritual drinking of alcoholic beverages, not as any kind of form of sensuality, let alone indulgence. It was to purposely put spiritual aspirants who are very strictly ethical-based yogis to make them do things that would bring shame. And the whole test was, can you engage in these actions as ritual and not feel shame because you've broken the taboos? That's a completely different mindset than Tantra in the West, which is, oh, get your partner, come to Hawaii, you know, we'll have a sensual experience of it. We'll sip wine with each other, listen to music, make love, and, you know, have the full sensual experience. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, just don't call it Tantra, because that's not even what left-hand Tantra was about. Now, right-hand Tantra in India was about realizing the conjoined nature of divine formlessness and formfulness, divine quiescence and divine vibratory power. It's the whole cosmos. So that's where the word Shakti arose. Shakti is the power of Shiva, the divine formless, worldless, spaceless, timeless self nature, divine self nature, the I am that am. It's Shakti power. Or substitute the word in the John Gospel, the logos, power of the word. And vibratory power is what can give rise to the whole universal play of consciousness. And then each individuated personal consciousness, each viewpoint on reality. That's the Shakti, the power to manifest universal consciousness field and worlds upon worlds, multidimensional in their scope. And manifest individual beings that seem to be like the subjective empirical experiencers. Now the me's, this me and that me, this person, that person, human, animal, celestial, you know, kind of persons, our ancestors and nature spirits and so forth, high angels. All of these persons are manifestations of the one suprapersonal. It uses the manifesting power of Shakti to manifest all these persons, their viewpoints, or souls. It's staggering in its miraculousness.
Right, well, she's not here, so I don't know if there was anything else she wanted from that question. I suppose she's planning to listen to the recording later. Let's see, I'm not sure. There's a lot of typing on the board. People are definitely saying things. I'm not sure which ones are questions. It's hard for me to listen to Timothy and read everything you are typing. So if you have a question, maybe highlight it with two or three question marks or something so that it jumps out at me and I can see it. Or remember, you all can put your hand up and I'll turn the mic over to you. I do see, Larry has typed, thank you, Timothy Conway, for fearlessly addressing our shared responsibility and ethical participation in the life now, and not copping out with statements such as, the world is not real. And then he says, long live the whales and dolphins. So I don't know that anybody was really offended by your sharing. I don't see, I do see, let's see, here's a question from Igor. If you feel bad for animals, why don't you feel bad for vegetables? Isn't that specialness? Each potato you eat, you kill, cabbage, carrot, et cetera. So I don't know if you want to briefly say anything about that. There is a hand up also. So just to let you know, somebody's waiting to ask you a question. But what about killing vegetables? Is that different?
Entirely different. It's a whole different order of life in the different kingdoms of life. And as we know, it's not just animal and plant. There's fungi. Every time you see a mushroom, that's a different order of life on this planet. It's neither plant nor animal. And then they found out there's like two or three other kingdoms of life in the soil. That's a more recent discovery, just of like the last 20, 25 years. Here's the thing. If there was a fire, you came home from somewhere and your house was on fire and you have pets and plants, which are you going to prioritize to take out of the building?
Yeah.
I'm serious.
I know
I'm
you
serious.
Are.
You know, and it is humorous because it shows the ludicrousness of what the meat industry has indoctrinated people with. We're fed with all sorts of bad memes, thoughts that serve the corporate self-interest. And one of them is that, you know, oh, vegans are killing their plants. The poor carrots are suffering. Well, a carrot doesn't have a nervous system. A little male chick in Tyson poultry industry does have a fully developed nervous system and feels pain and anguish in ways that plants appear not to, because as far as we know, and I'm always open to new scientific discovery, plants don't have nervous systems. They don't have the powers of expressivity of persons. They don't show any signs on any level of mourning the loss of babies, for instance, the way dairy cows mourn the loss of their little veal, the calves that are taken away for the veal industry, or just simply taken away and used for pet food or something. That's horrible, where you feed, especially herbivore animals, when you feed them ground up animal parts, the rendered animal parts. And incidentally, if you're feeding your pets meat, make sure you're not, the labels don't show rendered animal parts. It's just like one of the foulest things you can put in your pet. Dogs can be complete vegans and flourish. There are now companies providing products and or just people teaching you how to do it yourself to have your cats be largely, if not totally vegan. They need that certain amino acids, but you can now supply that amino acid. You don't have to do it if it's canned pet food or kibble or something that has meat parts, especially rendered animal parts. So, look, I read what's-his-name's book about plants and their sensitivities and sensibilities. I nurture plants. I water them twice a week. I feed them. I have to prune them sometimes because, you know, if a leaf dies, you know, it's going to dissipate the life force. So you prune away that part of the plant. And I don't regard myself as having a green thumb, but I have great feeling for plants, and I am hurt when plants are hurt. I feel that empathetically, but it's clear to me the members of the plant kingdom, whereas they're maybe overseen and guided and helped by great deva spirits for the natural realm, they do not feel and express life from a personal viewpoint the way animals and humans and the beings in the subtle realms do. And if that's not clear to people, then look again. Really check it out. Study. Open up your heart mind and find out what's true.
Yeah.
But I find it's just become an extremely cheap rationalization today to just kind of go, oh, you vegans, you know, you're killing plants. We kill you know, chickens, what's the big difference? There's a huge difference.
Yeah. Well, I had a mystical experience once when somehow the awareness that I am shifted into an apple. And when I was the apple, there was a bite taken out of me. And the way that I experienced that was, I always tell people, first of all, as an apple, I didn't experience myself as an apple. That's from a human point of view. I experienced myself as, you know, what you might call light, life, awareness. Mm-hmm. And the teeth, I also experienced as light, life, awareness. And it was like an interaction of like with like. And there was no feeling of being eaten. There was a feeling of dancing, you know, the likeness of the teeth passing through the likeness of the apple felt like a joyous dance. So that was my experience as an apple.
And, you know, look right in the Bible. The earliest commandment is a command to be vegan. It's only after the time of Noah, when the plants were all deluged and underwater, that the permission is given to eat meat. I mean, not that I hold any stock in the historical, you know, the historicity or factuality of a lot that's in the Bible, but as long as people are going to look at, you know, is there some kind of theological base for what we should eat? Right there in the Bible, you eat plants first and foremost. And in cultures like Judaism and Islam, there's no way the kosher laws or the Sharia, halal, proper ethical killing of an animal in the world of Islam can be satisfied by the modern intensified industrial, you know, farming, you know, feedlot and slaughter systems. Those are just a violation of everything in the Judeo-Christian and Muslim tradition.
Well, this is a part of what I was thinking about when you were speaking. Yeah. And I do need to turn the mic over to Jay. He's been waiting patiently. But my grandma lived on a farm until she passed away. And, you know, when you look at the way she cared for her chickens and, you know, and all of that, it was much, much, much different. And maybe if things were back to those simpler times, people wouldn't feel as bad about, you know, eating eggs, eating meat. I mean, she cared for those animals and loved those animals. She still ate them because that's all that she knew. But they're, you know, everything, when she killed them, it was done very quickly. And, you know, everything was very different than what you're describing. So, and you
there are some long time, you know, humane farmers who finally even left that because they realized there's still some horrible practices like putting rings in the nose, castrating little male piglets and stuff that they find at this point as they develop ethically, it's still unconscionable.
Yes.
And of course, everyone who thinks they can, you know, just go to Whole Food and get their quote humane meat. Well, all the exposés are showing the so-called humane meat. That's just another big corporate lie. The actual lives of these animals that supposedly are coming through humane farming systems is still a darn nightmare.
Well, let me turn the mic over to Jay. He has been sitting here for probably at least 10 minutes waiting. So, Jay, the mic is yours. Now he's not taking the mic. Let's see. Jay, are you still there? Maybe he, did you run off to the bathroom or something? the mic is yours, Jay, if you want it. And Sonia, he answered your question about Shakti while you were gone. Here you go, Jay. Oh, wait. Jay seems to have disappeared. Let's see. There he is. Okay, Jay, go ahead and take the mic.
Oh, hey, Timothy, I met you out in Santa Barbara. Good to hear you again. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, what is your thought? Do you think that awakening is possible, not necessarily having either the full information or awareness of this unethical treatment of animals that you're describing, and or necessarily the practice of veganism? Do you see that as an essential part of the process of awakening in general? That's my question.
All right. So let me take the mic back. All right, Timothy, you can answer him.
Well, namaste, Jay. Good to hear from you. And I remember you very clearly from what it was about 15 months ago here in Santa Barbara when you were visiting as part of the retreat and also mentoring people and so forth, a beautiful presence in the world. In answer to your question, let's go back to that Chan Buddhist very balanced sensibility about what awakening involves. There's this direct, sudden, intuitive awakening to what we intrinsically, innately are as the unborn absolute. This is timeless. This is what you are prior to any arising thoughts, actions, intentions, process of attention, prior to all the aspects of personhood. What are you? You are this vast openness. And so in the Chan Buddhist tradition, they would speak of direct sudden awakening to this intrinsic absolute Buddha nature. And the Buddha nature is actualized through this spontaneous, ego-free, but very powerful unfolding of potentials that they call the gradual cultivation. You know, in China, they referred to spiritual practices as cultivation. It's a very earthy, agrarian kind of metaphor. So, you know, just like it takes time for a plant to develop out of a seed, you know, into a little sprout and then a fuller grown plant structure. So also the actualization of our Buddha nature happens over time as a process of cellular evolution, becoming more skilled, more inwardly strong, patient, fearless, truly courageous, deeply empathetic, full of loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy, you know, as the Buddha describes some of these Brahma Viharas, the divine qualities or divine abodes. So all of that takes time. The turning of a sinner into a full-blown saint, with all the divine potentials activated, that's going to take, you know, lifetimes. And that's why there is the rebirth cycle. It kind of basically fleshes out the old Christian notion of purgatory. It's not that you go to some realm and suffer for a long time in some fiery realm and then you go to heaven. No, these rebirths involve the pain of birth, growth, decay, old age, and death, as the Buddha said. Ongoing life is a kind of purgatory. But it may not be seen in those kind of negative, merely purification terms. It's a great adventure. It's the unfolding of all the potentials of each and every absolutely unique expression of the absolute. So awakening, so sudden, direct, in this intuitive knowing by being that we are the absolute, the formless, the unborn, the unseen seer of seeing, the unheard hearer of hearing, the unfelt feeler of feeling, the great truth, spiritual, right now, closer than the eyeballs, closer than thought, right here, immediate, direct. This is our open spiritual nature. It's what we've always already been. Awakening to this is the sudden awakening. But allowing this open, ego-free, vaster than vast, subtler than subtle, pure, pristine spirit to actually play within the dream in a beautifully responsible way, a way full of loving kindness, empathetic compassion, caring, deep, the buck stops here, kind of responsibility and accountability, that's going to involve ethical development and growth. And so I say there's all sorts of people. We know them from history. We know it from our contemporary period, you know, peer group. We know there's all sorts of people that are experiencing sudden awakening to their suprapersonal, prior to personal nature. Now, how is that actually getting lived? And I'm simply saying with a lot of my focus tonight on this one particular hugely important ethical issue, because it's killing people prematurely. It's the major, major cause by far for climate change and so forth and so on, not to mention what it's doing to all these poor, innocent, helpless animals who value their lives the way we value ours. I focus on this because it's a major, major part of the ethical development, the actualization of real loving kindness and compassion, empathy, and a shared sense of who we are together. So when I speak of persons, I mean not just human persons, the 7.2 billion alive right now on the planet, coming into birth, little babies, and those leaving the body and physical death. I also refer to the animal persons, and people should know this simple statistic. In a given year, something like 50 to 55 billion animals, most of them chicken and turkeys, but an awful lot of pigs and cattle and sheep, are perishing after absolutely misery-inflicted lives. Who's inflicting the misery? The humans. As one Jewish scholar, poet, thinker said, you know, for the animals, it's an eternal Treblinka. It's the ongoing Holocaust, the one that existed before the Nazis' horrifying final solution, exterminating Jews in Central and Eastern Europe, and homosexuals and, quote, undesirables under the Nazis. That was about in terms of the actual killing, it was only, you know, a 5 to 10 year long Holocaust. But animals, especially under modern factory farm, kind of fish farm conditions, that's the ongoing Holocaust that never seems to end. It is lessening. In the United States, something like 400 million fewer animals were killed last year. And it's because a lot of young people were the least indoctrinated into the meat cult, dairy cult, are going vegan or near vegan. So there's the food industry knows it. The meat substitute, you know, vegan plant food substitutes for meat products and dairy products as well. That share of the food market, big food, big corporate food, they know that's the growing segment. And that's why some of the fast food chains are starting to introduce vegan things. They've sure been dragging their feet about it, even when they knew the horror and cruelty to the animals their contractors were involved with. They know that the young people are starting to get it. So they fear loss of market share. They want that market. So they're being kicked and dragged economically into honoring a more plant-based diet in some ways. Now they just have to, dare I say it, go full hog to save those poor pigs and cattle and poultry. So I don't know if I've answered your question. Just be aware that awakening is kind of two-step. Direct intuitive awakening to our timeless, unborn absolute nature. And then there's the actualization of that and how it gets lived at the level of the personal consciousness.
There's a lot of interesting comments on the board I'm looking in.
Yeah.
One friend, Igor, he says, how about humans? How many humans were killed violently last year? Is your joining with their suffering helping you to awaken in any way? What do you have to say about, and Dansa says she asked a question up above. Is it why do we eat vegetarian animals? Is that your question, Dances? I'm not sure. Like I said, when I'm listening to Jay, no, retype your question. So I'm listening to Timothy. I'm giving him my full attention. And so it's hard for me to pay attention to the board. If I was reading the board, I'd be ignoring Timothy. I can't do two things at once. So if you could retype your question, Dances, that would be great because I don't know what it was. But anyway, briefly, I'll watch for Dances' question. But briefly, what about things like, I don't know. Oh, wait, Dances has her hand up, so I won't go on. I will just pass the mic over to Dances. Yeah. Dances, the mic is yours.
Yes, I just wanted to ask if Timothy can touch on, there's been experiments into water and they photographed it. Where energy is put on, energy and intent put onto the water, like even just holding a bottle of water and it changes the water, the energy. And they did, you know, they showed pictures of water drops and how much it changes based on whether it was, you know, putting a violin intent on it. It was an experiment, putting a violin intent on it. And then this kind of ties into the macrobiotics, which I heard you speak about, so I know you're familiar. The energy and the intent that goes into it. Do you have any comments about that, or can you touch on that?
All right.
Dropping the mic. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Okay, let me take the mic back. I'll let you know when I have it. All right, Timothy, please go ahead.
Thank you, Dances, for your question. I'm aware of studies that show space itself can be imprinted by subtle energy and the intentions and emotions of humans. There were some studies out of Australia over 20 years ago I was reading about. Don't ask me to quote the authors' names. I wouldn't be able to cite them at this point. I'm aware of some of those water studies from some time ago. Maybe there's more recent ones. I know there was a lot of controversy within the field of peer-reviewed science as to how valid and reliable those kind of studies were. But, you know, it's my own feeling and sensitivity that, sure, subtle energy is real. You can just feel it in your hands. And when you're with a fellow living being, the field of chi energy or the prana shakti or the orgone energy, as a student of Freud, Wilhelm Reich called it back in the 30s and 40s, we know this is real. The Chinese government knows that. They had all these studies out of Beijing University showing there is this energy and field of energy we can call qi energy, with a qigong master. Part of it is they seem to be better oxygenating their tissues. That's part of it. But there's this X factor. It's another kind of energy. And that's why those studies, those revelations in cosmology and astrophysics from 1998 onward were so profound, because it shows there is much more to energy than is manifesting in the normally detectable ways of the scientific methodology that, you know, we've received over the growth of Western science the last 400 years. So, yeah, I think let us honor our intentions. Let us realize we are a part of a great nexus, a great web, an intermeshed, intermingled web of life. And let us be beings of peace. We can't become beings of peace on our own. It happens through that miracle of surrender. The divine within us, in us, surrenders the personal consciousness back to the superpersonal. And God is doing our spirituality. God is our peace and making the personal consciousness more peaceful. If I, me, Timothy, conditioned old Timothy, strive for peace and try to fabricate peace, I only create some bizarre kind of restlessness. I create a maintenance project of trying to maintain a divine state of peace. I can't do that. I don't even know how to grow a single hair or digest a single morsel of food I swallow. So it's all happening by the great power of the one power, formless, shapeless, divine power that's doing everything. Surrender is paradox, is spiritual surrender. Because ultimately it's realized who is surrendering, what is being surrendered, and what is the act of surrendering. And yet it happens, just like planets happen, and springtime and summer and fall and winter happen, and, you know, the waking state, the dreamless sleep all rotate and happen one after the other by the power, miraculous power of this one. So let us be, through the power of this one, beings of peace. Let our subtle energy and how it communicates or resonates with fellow subtle energy fields, let it all be grand and beautiful, filled with divine qualities.
Maybe Dance's question kind of led into what I was going to ask. I was going to ask a question based on the fact that Igor had said something about what of all of the human suffering, you know, the violence, and I'm going to call it the violence in the human life, because there's other types of sufferings, but I think we're more specific to violence. But then you talked about how, you know, our intent and our peacefulness even shapes the space. So if we were interested in, for lack of better words, helping to reduce human violence, but of course I you know, how do we do that? How can we do that?
It's the growth of empathy. You can teach empathy to little children rather than teaching authoritarianism and narrow-minded, it's my way or the highway agendas. Robert Altmaier's tremendous work. I mean, he's resurrected all this work that was kind of dismissed and discounted from the late 40s and 1950s by mainly European psychologists. How did Nazi Germany happen, they wondered. And they articulated what they called the authoritarian personality, that's too quick to give orders or obey blindly obey orders. And we had all those social psychology experiments by Stanley Milgram and Philip Zimbardo and others, Zimbardo at the Stanford prison, the experiments where he took undergrads and created a mock prison there at Stanford in the psych department, had to stop the experiment when he began to discuss it with his lady partner. She made him go back and stop the experiment because you had kids acting in sadistic ways and other people just falling into horrible states of feeling subjugated and disempowered. The Stanley Milgram obedience experiments, you know, someone would be willing to deliver electric shocks to a lethal level if there was just someone standing in a white lab coat, the official experimenter type, telling them you must proceed further with the experiment, you can't stop. The experimenter had a cohort, an older gentleman playing an actor playing the subject of the experiment, who was in some learning situation where he had to answer questions properly. And the actual subjects were the people being brought in off the street who were told, you know, you're getting paid for this experiment, and it's an experiment in learning to see if that gentleman there over there in the booth can properly answer the questions you read from this list of questions. Well, the real experiment, it wasn't about the old man properly answering the questions. The real experiment is, how willing are you to deliver the electric shock to the old man? Now, no actual electric shock was being given, but the setup, and that's why they hired an actor, was that with every miss by the old gentleman, you had to increase the electric voltage and the shock you were delivering. And unbeknownst to the subjects off the street, that old man, he wasn't being shocked at all by any electric apparatus, but he was acting as if he was. And they found out something like 80% of the people were willing to go along the highest level, even after the old gentleman had kind of gasped and slumped and looked to be unconscious and maybe dead. They would still keep delivering ever greater electric shocks just because the authoritarian figure told them to do so. So our society is rife with authoritarianism, and it completely dominates one of our political parties. John Dean, a former Republican, back in the 80s and 90s, was writing books lamenting the hard right direction of his former Republican Party that he belonged to as a moderate Republican. And he used a lot of Robert Altmaier's work that resurrected all the studies and went much, much further into looking at authoritarianism. That's the bane of humanity at the corporate level, the political level, the religious level, this authoritarianism, which has zero empathy, thinks in very stark black and white terms. It's very much about, you know, we are the chosen ones. We will be rewarded by God or the great leader, whomever, the Fuhrer, Donald Trump, whatever. We will be rewarded by being obedient to that kind of authority. And it loses all nuanced capacity for thinking, feeling, sharing, empathizing. And that's where you get the great terrible wars of killing and the pogroms, Christians slaughtering Jews, Christians slaughtering Muslims, Muslims slaughtering Christians. It all comes from this lack of empathy. And what is the enemy of empathy? Authoritarianism. So Robert Altmaier, this psychologist, did all this yeoman work to resurrect the significance of the concept in psychology of the authoritarian personality. He was saying the only way we can root this out is by modeling for one another non-authoritarian ways of feeling, thinking, behaving, educating one another. And so may empathy grow. That's what will be the antidote to all the humans killing humans and humans killing animals. When humans, like those little boys, social workers are always on the lookout in every community in the world where there are social workers. They're on the lookout, especially for little boys that have zero empathy and torture animals. They know that's the first sign in the possible very distorted development that could lead later on to a serial killer, a wife beater, an abuser of children. It's someone who has that sociopathic tendency to treat others merely as its, as objects. And that's why, I've said it before, like when so many of you were up on the retreat out in Santa Barbara, the acme, the summit of true spiritual awakening. It's to the suprapersonal, not the impersonal, but the suprapersonal. Because if you think spirituality is awakening to the impersonal, then the path of your spirituality should be toward depersonalization. And that part of that road is treating yourself and everyone else merely as an it object, and having zero empathy for what they are actually going through as this poignant, wabi-sabi characterized person, an individuated viewpoint on the great reality. So a true sage is awake as the suprapersonal, but loves and cherishes with great empathy and loving kindness the persons. And it's spontaneously the case that you love animals, you love fellow humans, you abhor violence in all of its forms, all of its forms. And you try to educate and heal individual behavior, corporate behavior, national, political behavior that trounces on the rights of persons, be they humans or animals. So, you know, Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi said, those that don't really know think that religion has nothing to do with politics, but those who really have come alive with all this know that religion has everything to do with politics. Politics is our policies, our public policies, our corporate policies, our policies as communities and nations and groups of nations. We need to grow up. We need to develop empathy. We need to outgrow selfish narcissism and dangerous demonic authoritarianism. It's that simple. And that profound.
All right.
Great adventure.
Now we are officially out of time, but I think someone else has asked a question. How do you feel about that? Are you okay to answer one more question?
Oh, I'm happy to answer however many questions people wish to step.
All right. Let me see. Let's see. It says, Timothy, this is from Larry. Timothy, how do you address the reality of climate change with, and then he says, A Course in Miracles-ers, meaning people who study A Course in Miracles, who deny the reality of the real world, confusing it with judgmental, egoic metaphor of the world.
Yeah. Well, I've gone on record. I finally put up that page of critique at the website, which has gotten some flack, but you know, also a lot of appreciation from certain people. The Course in Miracles is fantastic in the realm in which it operates. And I've explained before in other interviews with you, Regina Dawn, on that retreat, and it's certainly up there at the website. I've got that enlightened-spirituality.org website. The three levels, simultaneously true levels, there's the absolute truth, which is not really a level, but for the sake of this educational schema, we'll speak of the absolute level. And then there's the number two level, which is like everything's perfect. You know, whatever is born is divinely emanated and destined for perfection. And timelessly, we can speak of it as already being perfect because ultimately time is just an illusion. So all souls are already perfect, already fully developed, fully divine. They emanate at their inception as pure emanations out of the divine heart mind, full of divine light and love. So that's a level two. It's all perfection. You know, there's no need for any judgment or criticism on a level that's referring to this always already perfect domain. But then there's what I call level three, which is the pragmatic functional level. And this is the level of good and evil, skillful and unskillful, helpful and harmful. That's male and female, positive and negative charge. It's the whole play of the opposites. The dwandvas, as they call them in ancient India, the play of the opposites. And it's on this level that beings need to be ethically responsible and accountable, develop empathy, heal their own sinful tendencies, quote unquote, their selfish tendencies that are hurtful to other beings. It's the level where we grow up, where we evolve, we outgrow our, unwholesome personality habit patterns, the samskaras, to use that all-important word in ancient India, the Hindus and Buddhists. Your samskaras are your stuff, your material. It's what you need to outgrow and have refined by the divine healing power refinement and correction and growth and purification. So I hope that answers the question.
Larry, did that answer the question? I think it's a matter of levels, and at this level, he is saying we do need to exercise that discernment.
Yeah, Course in Miracles is largely only speaking on level two. They don't even do a really good job of speaking at level one. For that, you need those really apophatic mystical texts, like the Eastern traditions, starting with India, and then the Far East picked up on them, these, you know, totally awakened from the dream, totally awakened to the transcendent. In the Western Christian tradition, it was the Neoplatonic current of thinking, with the so-called Pseudo-Dionysius, and early mystics in Western tradition, and people like Meister Eckhart and so forth, that apophatic, formless, awakened to the absolute kind of mysticism. The Course in Miracles isn't even really that good about talking on that level one. Only God, only God, right. Only God, only God, only God, nothing, worldless.
Yeah, I've noticed. Somewhere.
So Course in Miracles is mainly talking on level two. And on that level, it does a very good job. It's very eloquent in many areas. But it completely falls down when it comes to level three, the pragmatic, practical responsibilities and duties and the forms of growth and development of virtues on the practical level. I know it helps people on this level when you undo selfishness, when you allow love to replace fear and hate and all the other unwholesome, distorted forms of reaction, the pure radiant emotions of love, bliss, divine kindness and exuberance. But it doesn't directly do a good job. I mean, you'll find nothing in the Course in Miracles to reinforce the engaged spirituality of a Mahatma Gandhi or Dorothy Day before Gandhi or, you know, Nelson Mandela or anyone on the front lines of dealing with economic injustice, racial injustice, gender injustice, species injustice, environmental injustice. For that, you need to look to other works and a broader, hopefully three-level broad, only God, level one, level two, which addresses and honors the multiplicity of souls, yet looks in them timelessly as always already perfect in a kind of heavenly way, the God's view of all the souls. And then this level three, which is all about the pragmatic level of justice and injustice, what's true and what's false, what's helpful and what's harmful.
If someone was looking for a spiritual path that had a balance of the levels, is there a spiritual path that you recommend or a book that you recommend? Or
Read a lot of that stuff that's on my website. All of that comes out of that sensibility of balance. Engaged Buddhism, I think, you know, the writings of Thich Nhat Hanh, a number of other engaged Buddhists, certain engaged Hindus, Vimala Thakkar comes out of that kind of engaged Hindu tradition. They may not get the full realization of the formless absolute. And so for some people, they're going to have to kind of mix and combine. Just like we mix and combine different kind of plants at a wholesome plant-based meal. We're not only going to eat legumes or only going to eat nuts and seeds or only eat fruit or grains. There's combinations. I was feeling the truth in this combinational way coming out of these apophatic mystical traditions and also the literature that speaks more to that level two, the intrinsic perfection of all beings, and everything is working for the best for those that love the Lord. Whatever happens is meant to happen. Otherwise, something else would be happening, because anything and everything happens only by the power of this, which allows anything to happen. So I realized that level two, all of these realizations came before I read any books, mind you. So you don't have to read anything at all. It's the balanced spiritual truth revelation that will come from the depths of what you are.
That's, and also that's what Awakening Together is all about, is that balance that you're talking about. I mean, really looking at the different spiritualities so we can get the sense that's between all the words that has that balance. It's not lopsided.
And I honor you for being a shining beacon in that way, Regina Dawn, and your whole community. Anyone who's staying with you is obviously also deeply interested in and moved by and inspired by that consummate spiritual balance, the formless and the forms,
yes. The
supersonal and the personal individuations of the absolute.
Well, so, and again, it's important to know that. It's important to know that second level, I think. Or you have difficulty with what I'm going to call self-forgiveness, especially if you can't.
Yes. Also, let me say that, you know, just contemplating the suffering of all the animals in the food system, the so-called food system, the pseudo-deranged food system, just contemplating that for more than 5 minutes, you could go absolutely insane.
Yes.
From the horror, the heinousness of it, the hideous, foul, unethical evil of it all. You could become easily a misanthrope. You would wind up hating humans that are complicit in all this institutionalized torture, confinement, and suffering, and slaughter. So there has to be something of that level two, and certainly the level one, it's all only God, only God. Otherwise, you go stark raving mad.
Yeah.
And not just with the animal situation, how, you know, women, females are abused in so many cultures, how those among the poor, the lower members of the socioeconomic status totem, how they are treated in different cultures as pariahs, as non-persons. You'll go mad contemplating all of this if you're only sensitive to and kind of awake to and aware of level three reality, the pragmatic level.
I was going to read something to you, but I have it in the other room. I won't go grab it, but you might be familiar with it. It's from St. Thomas Aquinas. How do you say his name? Aquinas?
Aquinas. St. Thomas Aquinas,
yes.
The great Orthodox theologian who at the very end of his life, when asked why he didn't finish his Summa Theologica, his great summation of Western theology, he said, because after what God has shown me, everything I have written, which is, of course, the thesis for all Western Orthodox Christian theology, everything I have written, he said, is as so much straw.
Yes, that I understand with all of my writing. I understand that statement. Yeah. It's hard for me. People
want me. What did Thomas Aquinas say that he read?
It was like a story where he's talking to God. And he's saying, please, God, let me love all of you. And God says, basically, you could never do that. You don't have the ability. And he's like, please, please, God, let me love you. And, you know, God tells him again, you never could. He's like, please. And he says, okay, but I have this blemish on me. Although it's just a small part of what I am, I have this blemish on me that if I reveal it to you, you know, you'll run away in fear. And he's like, please, please, God, you know, let me love you. And he says, the blemish is all of the cruelty and all of the hatred. Are you willing to kiss that too?
Profound statement. You know, that was the great Juliana of Norwich, that great Christian contemplative woman who confined herself finally to a small hermitage cell located right next to the cathedral at Norwich, England. And she was very perturbed by level three, you know, the problems of right and wrong, good and evil, cruel and callous behavior, apathetic behavior, and then all the suffering of people. And she knew her church's teaching. There was only Roman Catholicism then in the West. There had not yet occurred the Protestant Reformation, I should say. She knew the church's teaching that the evildoers would be damned forever to hell, and she had compassion for them, just as she had compassion for the victims of the evildoers. And she was very perturbed. How could an all-good, all-knowing, all-loving God, you know, omniscient and omnipotent, how could this all-good, all-knowing, all-powerful God allow evil, allow evildoers, allow the suffering of the innocent? And Christ appeared to her in a series of revelations, and the climax of that revelation, the great crescendo climax of it, was that the theologians don't know everything, that there is, in fact, no eternal hell, and that all beings, including the evildoers, even Satan will be saved. This was none other. In her own way, she was getting the revelation that a lot of early Christians knew on a widespread level. The best, most brilliant theologians taught it. It was the doctrine of apokatastasis, universal salvation, the Greek word apokatastasis. And what Christ revealed to her, and a much more memorable phrase than the tongue twister word apokatastasis, was all is well, and all manner of things are well and shall be well. This was the great revelation to Juliana, that God was somehow going to make it all right. And that's a level two realization.
Yeah, yeah.
The intrinsic and ultimate, eventual, destined, divinely destined perfection, moral perfection, spiritual perfection of all souls. And so that helped heal that horrible, nightmarish suffering and concern she had for all the suffering of the innocents at the hands of the evildoers, and then all the evil that the evildoers were going to experience. I'm sorry, the suffering the evildoers were going to experience as a consequence of their evil actions. That helped heal her terrible emotional distress and allowed peace. She basically, you know, was able to allow a realization that acknowledges the terrible suffering. You cannot understate it. You cannot cover up your eyes in the face of it. You can't shut your ears off to the cries of sentient beings, which is why, like, Guan Yin, the great bodhisattva, really kind of a deity, feminine deity of East Asia, her name literally means she who hears the cries of suffering beings. She's not closing your ears off to that. She's fully engaged, fully involved. Humanity's pain, the pain of all the animals, is her pain. So to be able to take on, in full empathy and full solidarity, the suffering of beings exposed to the terrible intensity of pain, you have to be liberated from your own smallness and pettiness and narrowness and frailty. There needs to be an awakening and tremendous courage, tremendous strength, and only the divine can do this. And that kind of points back to that Thomas Aquinas story you shared. Now, to really look into the heart of the absolute, which is worldless and personless, yet manifests these perfected souls, and further manifests the great adventure of perfect souls taking on embodiments as animals and humans and subtle plane kind of beings, beings maybe in other physical civilizations, and then the whole play of good and evil that ensues, and all the suffering through the injustices of one person or group mistreating other persons and groups. To really take that on, to fully feel it, to not close off the heart, and also not throw anyone out of your heart, the perpetrators, the perceived perpetrators of the evils. That is consummate, balanced spirituality. It requires everything. It requires the surrender of any narrowness or smallness, because you'll be done in by it. You can't keep your heart open to the massive pain that is ongoing for sentient beings.
Yes.
Unless you really awaken to the superpersonal, to the divine nature. That's why the sages are the most compassionate of all. They don't close off. They don't, in denial and rationalization, you know, they don't seek out forms of escapism, mere entertainment, just to, you know, get their little gleeful elation over this titillation or that titillation. No, they are awake to and alive to and identified with and as each and every being, including beings in great joy and pleasure and beings in great pain, suffering, trauma. And so this is a mature spirituality. It outgrows all the puerile, childish forms of spirit. Jesus said, be like a child, innocent, open, and free. He didn't say become childish and narrow and selfish and pampered. And that's a great distinction. Let us be absolutely innocent like the pure-hearted children, and let us be really, really, really super mature, outgrowing all of our nonsense that we simply don't need anymore. We've outgrown it.
Thank you.
De nada, señora. You're welcome.
So I will write to you tomorrow, so you'll get an email from me tomorrow. But I want to thank you very, very much. You've given everyone a lot to contemplate, I think, and that's very important. So thank you. And
your image froze. I didn't hear the last 10 seconds or so.
Well, basically, I was saying thank you. I think you've given everyone a lot to really contemplate, and that's nice because they contemplate and they can go within deeper. So thank you very much.
You're more than welcome. Contemplate thyself, who thou art, and who everyone is around you in your world, and you will find all of this. And Timothy's words will be utterly expendable and non-necessary.
Thank you, Timothy. I will write to you tomorrow.
Namaste, Regina.
Namaste.
Diamond, to each and every one.
Bye-bye.
Be well.
Thank you.
Bye.